The Center for Community and Economic Development at Michigan State University's podcast, Transforming Tomorrow Together, Today, creates informative episodes in collaboration with MSU faculty, students, community leaders, changemakers, and stakeholders that highlight innovative tools, models, policies, and professional insights to co-create sustainable prosperity and more equitable economies with communities. I'm your host, Mary Zimbrunnen, Assistant Director of the Center.
Today, we are continuing the Center's interview with CityCraft founder and board chair, John L. Knott Jr., regenerative system scale strategist, Melissa Hall, and CityCraft board member, Brent Forsberg. Let's get into part two of three, discussing the Southwest Lansing Regenerative Roadmap and Lansing Growth Fund. The views discussed during this podcast are those of the guest and do not represent the opinions of Michigan State University, the Center for Community and Economic Development, or any affiliated organizations.
Specifically at the corner of Holmes and Pleasant Grove, tell me about the work that is going on there and honoring Malcolm X's legacy and the site of the school that he used to attend.
Yeah. So the project going in at Holmes and Pleasant Grove is going to be three phases. The first phase is starting spring of 2026. So that's really exciting. And it's going to have 30 apartment buildings. It's got mixed use with LAFQ coming in with a bank branch. They're bringing in their Stable Communities Foundation and a business accelerator that will be in the building. The work is being built on that corner becoming one of the neighborhood centers of Southwest Lansing and being a place for people to gather. The site was a school, the Pleasant Grove School, which Malcolm X attended. And the community is coming together with a committee to say, how do we honor his time here and Malcolm X on the site? So built within the infrastructure of the site will be a memorial. And the committee right now is actively putting ideas together that as the project is being going through its construction phase, we'll be working on scoping that in to integrate to tell some of that story as part of the project. It's really exciting, and it gets back to, again, the values of what's the story the community wants to tell about itself and celebrate the people of the community. And this is a significant piece of the project of being able to tell stories and bring people together and have the foundation and have opportunities come out of the site. And as the site continues to grow, we'll look at what other opportunities are available from the needs that are identified from the roadmap and the collection with the collaboration with the community to say, what do the next phases look like?
On the website at LansingGrowthFund.com, you quote Malcolm X saying, "No man has believed perfectly until he wishes for his brother what he wishes for himself." Can you tell me what that means in relationship to this project?
Well, I think it's actually core to what we do. In the Bible, you know, in the New Testament, the whole idea is, you know, what are you called to do? And it is love your God with all your mind, your heart and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. And I was raised by the Jesuits, and I was taught that I'm supposed to be a man for others, not just for myself. And so, you know, if you love your neighbor as yourself, you are what you wish for yourself. You wish for your neighbor. And that means you have to know your neighbor and you have to understand them and you have to care about them. And that's what we do in our community engagement work, is to enable people to have the time to understand and get to know their neighbor and really get to know them more deeply, where they can come together as common values and then build a community around those values.
When do you break ground on this exciting project?
It will be breaking ground spring here of 2026. We're finishing up the construction schedule right now, and it'll be pretty close. We don't have an exact date for when the shovels were going in the ground, but they're already working to start site prep and get everything ready to go. And the completion date right now is estimated for end of February, beginning of March in 2027.
Okay, so pretty soon.
Yes.
And Mary, if I can circle back around to the quote from that Malcolm X, John and I a lot talk about how we were raised and how similar it is. And one of the things that my mom always taught me and I taught my son is to be other people minded. And my mom would actually say, whatever you would do for yourself, go a step beyond for someone else. And she would teach us that even if you were to stay in a hotel, how you would leave your own house, leave that hotel even better. So his quote does remind me of my upbringing as well, just to be other people minded, but go beyond what you'll even do for yourself.
Yes, rings of the golden rule.
Yeah, it seems we've forgotten that.
Yeah.
Some of us haven't, but I think that that's why I think one of the fundamental differences between our work and everything else is that we live in an extraction economy that's short-term focused, and we believe in building capacity and long-term investment and building value and for the community itself and reinvesting in the community, not extracting completely from it.
As you mentioned extraction, I have to touch on circularity for just a moment and thinking about the regenerative piece of the roadmap. How does circular economics tie into your work?
How do I answer that question? It doesn't tie into our work. It is our work.
Ah.
Okay, it is. So I'm going to give you an analogy. So an oak tree in a forest, between its root system and everything else, is a fully integrated organism that's tied to many other organisms from below the soil to reaching to the sky. When spring comes, or whatever time the acorns fall or are there, those are seeds. And there, for that one tree, there's millions of seeds that are being propagated, potentially propagated. They might be eaten by squirrels and other people, but that's being propagated too, because the acorn becomes squirrel. And the shedding of their leaves, the shedding of the bark, all of that becomes nutrient in soil or the below ground ecosystem. The tree is constantly in living in an environment of regeneration. There's no waste because of the way, I mean, unfortunately, we think the leaves are waste, which they're not. They're actually a nutrient for the other species in soil. And so we view a circular economy exactly that way. And capital for us is human beings are capital. I mean, it's the most important capital you have in a city. We just don't count it. So the circularity isn't just about money, it's about all systems that are part of the capital system, which is the ecosystem itself. And so what we're trying to do is to get people, one, to understand that and value it. Because if they don't value it, then it's not going to happen long term. Two, we're trying to build infrastructure that enables money that comes in from the external world, goes into a building or into a grocery store or into a bank, and it stays in that community and reinvests in that community, just like the acorn tree is investing in the soil health and the bird and nesting health of the other species that occupies it.
For folks that are specifically focused on commerce and business, then, and the profit churning, what does that mean for a local economy and working where you live?
Oh, I'm going to give you an analogy, which is not off the subject. Everybody talks about affordable housing. If you look at our Noisette Master, the New American City Plan, you will see a section on. And the question is, why is housing not affordable? Not how do you make housing more affordable? Because if you ask the first, if you ask that second question, which is you just keep reducing the cost, which reduces the quality of the building. The reason housing is not affordable is one, the housing that we build or the existing housing isn't being maintained, and it costs a fortune just to heat and cool it. It also creates all kinds of health impacts for your children, etc. Two, jobs are way far away from where the home is, and so is the shopping. That means you got to have public transit. We don't have public transit, so we have to have cars, and cars cost a lot of money. And the average family has 2 to 3 cars. The average family in this country is spending more money on car payments and insurance and maintenance and filling that car than they are on the rent or mortgage on their house. Now, you talk about insanity. That's really insane. So, how we plan, where we place things, the way we create walkability and transport are all part of the housing affordability issue. And if the jobs are near, then people can get to their jobs without using a car. And by the way, walking is one of the best exercises you can do for your whole body. Every day, 3, 4, 5 miles, 7 days a week. But we design cities and we design areas like Southwest Lansing that have no sidewalks in a lot of places. And we don't have safe places for people to do a lot of this stuff. That is the way we used to design our cities for 200 plus years in this country. And somehow we got in our minds starting 50 or 60 years ago to just throw all that wisdom away and do what we're doing now. So when we talk about when we talk about building cities the way we're talking about or redeveloping, we're actually going back to the wisdom of the past. Cities grew from the edge, grew from the core. People could get to their jobs by walking. People could go to the grocery store. People could go to the doctor. People could go to the barber shop. Now everything is spread out. Everything is segregated and siloed. How many shopping centers or individual stores do you go into in Lansing where you go into the parking lot and you got to come back out on the road and get on the road in the tractor to go back in the place next door? Because you can't get to the store.
And
It's
certainly
just,
not within walking.
not within walking. Yeah.
So it's so the ill, and all of these things cost a fortune for developers and for cities and everything else. And the sprawl that we have in this country, in the last 40 years, we have decreased the numbers of people per acre, the number of people per acres by somewhere between 2 and 3 times. So it's that we have people being supported by 2 or 3 times more acreage than we used to, which means that all of our sewer, all of our water, all of our fire, all our infrastructure is having to go out to serve more and less and less people, which means it's costing per person a whole lot more. All of this, from a business standpoint, for the public sector, private sector, individual, makes no sense at all. And then we get in these battles about taxes. And because they don't want to pass taxes because the cost of the infrastructure is too much and all because of the sprawl, what we now have in this country, on average, infrastructure is 60 years behind in maintenance, and buildings are 40 years behind in maintenance, particularly in the public sector.
And you know what I love about John is a walker. He doesn't, if he has a choice between driving or walking, he's going to choose the walk, which means a lot of times I'm walking with him. But every time we take a walk, he has me looking at the buildings. He has me looking at the sidewalks. He starts to talk about the water system. He starts to talk about how it all flows together or where it's disconnected. John has given me a different perspective when I am looking at buildings now, and he'll explain to me how it is making an impact on the economy of how it's even built. I was just sharing that with Brent today, that I took a walk with John one day, and I said it's was one of my most impactful moments of my life. And I told him, I said, I've always been one that loves looking at historical buildings and enjoy the architect structure of a building. But John taught me a different way to look at it through the economic and ecological system. And I just shared with him today that it's amazing of how everything just connects together and it makes an impact on our life. And I would have never recognized it at that level until that first day I took a walk with him. But now it's a walk every time he's here.
It makes me revisit the idea of insanity too, and the definition of doing something over and over, repeating the same action, expecting a different outcome, and how we are not thinking in terms of silos, that we are acting in terms of silos, and how we need to align constellations and look holistically, turn our perspective holistically to ecosystems. So thinking about that, John, in our conversation this morning, we briefly touched on the idea of regenerative food systems, as well as having medical clinics in the same areas where we live, learn, work, and play, and as well as small scale manufacturing, thinking about reuse, refurbishment, recycling. Can you share some of the examples that we discussed from your previous work, both I will say rural and urban?
So in Denver, for example, we developed a there was a real need in this area to have food access and healthy food access. And we started with the Sun Valley Kitchen, and that expanded into a grocery store that was taking food from Whole Foods and Sprout and a number of others that were being thrown away every day. And then they started community gardens, and the community gardens I started pr deliver in the neighborhoods delivering food there as well. And then we then start with this community had like 30 some immigrant communities in it, 70 65,000 people. And so in the kitchen we were able to get some refrigeration and other things, and so they started t teaching them how to cook. And then grow the foods that they wanted for their cultural work, and then become active in restaurants. And even some started their own restaurants. And then we went to the next scale, which was, and this is prior to COVID, food system that would actually be a local full-scale food system for that region. And I think we covered at least three counties, and we had large-scale ranchers with high-quality meat products and others that are cooperatives. We Sun Valley, which was an economically challenged area, is where the Sun Valley Kitchen is. Those organizations started to distribute their food in that place, and so the wealthier people who were coming to get their food were coming there, and they were learning about food and learning about what was going on, and ultimately. We have a whole slide deck on this. There is, I think it was something like 35 or 45 different organizations and systems in this three county area, which allowed all of this food to be circulating within the local region. And then when COVID hit, it turned out we were the only entity that was, I shouldn't say we, I mean, we build capacity. So, we build capacity and we're a catalyst, so we disappear. So our role as a catalyst worked, and that whole program was able to provide food to all the essential workers. And I love that term. All the essential workers are generally the lowest paid workers, you find out. But delivering food to the police, to the fire department, to the sanitation workers, to the hospitals, that became the mission of that organization because it's the only one that had an integrated food system locally. So the supply chains that were being shut down for the grocery stores and everything else because of COVID did not affect that system. We have in Charleston, we set up the, we found out that 92% of all the construction and design firms were owned by white males. Not even women were allowed to be owning businesses. So we one of the things we did with the reconstruction that was going to go on in the new development, we set up a program for the historically underutilized businesses. I think it was 110 or 120 contractors and design firms that we went through our academy to set up to become operating businesses. And then we built collaborative networks for bidding that they could work together on. I think, and we essentially our local economic development group, Lowcountry Local First, which was one of the, I think it was the seventh chapter of BALE, the Business Alliance for Local Economies at that time, in the country. And that organization built a farm to table network, not just to the restaurants, but the grocery stores, set up a farming program where people were trained on a farm for 2 years, how to grow and operate an organic, sustainable farm, how to go to food markets and present their products and sell them and price them and all of that. I mean, we've been doing this for a long time. And what it does is it produces. Think about what happens. You don't have shipping, you don't have processing. Your supply chain is now not just down to 400 miles from 1400 miles, it's actually down to like 25 miles or 15 miles or 10 miles. So the economics of that change everything dramatically, and the quality that everybody's producing, and people know the artisans that are making things or the people that are growing things. The restaurants are connected to the farmers, and there's a you be, you rebuild this social system that was just fractured with this massive national, international supply chain system. Did I answer your question?
Yes. Thinking about women-owned businesses, construction, so forth, is there opportunity or discussion about bringing the academy to Michigan?
So one of the core pieces that we're working on in building community is creating better career pathways. And me being a little biased towards the built construction, construction is very important. So we've worked on a couple initiatives over the last 2 years on building connections of pathways for alternative ways to get into careers in construction. And that's something that as we continue to work to look at how do those opportunities to continue to grow, to bring as you mentioned, more women into construction, bringing other people that haven't had access to the trades to be able to get connected, to learn, to understand. And there is an ecosystem forming around Lansing on that. And we're excited with the success that we've had. We've worked with LIUNA for the last couple of years on testing programs for this and looking at what the next iteration of that's going to be.
Yes, Brent and I just had a pretty long conversation about this yesterday, and it continued a little today of understanding what resources are needed with the program and what would it look like. Because if you're, let's give the example, if you're working with people that are coming from the prison and transitioning into the workforce, what kind of resources are needed to support them to be successful in a program like that? If you're looking at at-risk children or young adults, what resources are needed to support them to be successful in a program like that? So we were just talking about that today, of trying to scope that out to make the pathway of construction. Just making sure that we have resources and tools in place to help people become successful. And when we participated in the Rosie the Riveter event, her and I were talking about the first woman that was ever a master pipe fitter. And how do you get women into this type of field, and how do you help them become successful in construction, in manufacturing, in skilled trades? So pieces are moving to bring all of that together. And best thing I can say is more to come, but I'm very, very excited about it, putting those things in place to help women and at-risk people to be successful in well-paying jobs.
Yeah, so Mary, there are Two additional areas I'd like to fo say is that the Alice Index population, which is essentially the employed working poor, working two or three jobs, but still can't buy a house, still can't afford a lot of things. Those populations, that population is ideal to move into careers, whether it be construction, whether it be ecosystem restoration, whatever the, and what we're doing is focusing on teaching people how to build regeneratively and how to do ecosystem restoration regeneratively and build career paths for the future, not just for the past, which is one of the problems we have in this country. We set up job training programs, and what happens is they're trained for a job, and then after 2 years, they're laid off. What we focus on is building careers. And we've been doing that. Our family and I myself have been involved since 1971, developing programs for career development with poverty communities, schools for the deaf, all kinds of alternative populations, and many prison reentry programs as well. And so it, and we're generally running between, 90 to 95% retention over 3 years on all those people over the years. So, just to give you a sense of how long we have been involved in this.
When we talk about underinvestment, we talk about opportunities. What it really comes down to is when we talk about affordability and career pathways, that alignment of the cost of living for the experience that people want in a community versus what they have for opportunities to gain wealth and earn money in a community. That's really what this is coming down to. One thing that I do want to say is I think Lansing as a region offers one of the greatest value propositions in the country. When you look at the assets that are here, when you look at the diversity in jobs, you look at education opportunities, access to career pathways, access to higher education here, it's amazing for the size of our community. And when you take the people here that are so focused on creating that better living experience, I just get really excited. And with what we're doing, being a piece of that is really exciting, and all the people that are around it making it work. And that's what this is really about, right? Is saying that, okay, this is the living experience we want. This is what it costs, not just money, but also, access to all of the other pieces of it, with the social aspects of it too, that bring the people together, that attract people, that allow that growth to continue. So, all of these different platforms that we're talking about really come down to creating that living experience based on the values of the community, and being able to keep that alignment going, to keep that compounding of the work that's been done in the past, to continue to grow and continue to attract more people, to get people to stay here, because that's the number one of the number one problems in Michigan, right? Is we are exporting our youth to other communities after they live here because they're perceiving better opportunities in other areas. So we have to tell that story better, that the opportunities are here, that the jobs are here, the experience, access to parks, art, restaurants, everything that people want, the organizations around that people want to be a part of, that it's all here, and that we have to continue to build those assets and continue to allow that to grow over time.
And even for the youth that doesn't leave here, because there isn't an opportunity for them to leave, but still giving access to them to be able to develop a career, develop resources where they are able to buy houses. And sometimes we'll say, get out of the renting situation and get into a house. But as John points out, sometimes the renting situation may be the best option for, not option, but best for their living situation. But to give them the opportunity where housing choices are available to them and they're able to choose. And when I say renting may be better for some, there are working professionals that, because of the busyness of life, they may choose to rent over home ownership. But just to build up our youth where they have options, rather it's the youth that normally would want to leave the city, but having things here and showing them things here to stay. There's also the youth that may not have an option of leaving just because of their living situation, but to create an environment for them where they can obtain housing and have housing opportunities.
I would agree with that 100%. As far as bang for the buck, affordability within the capital region is tremendous. And as well as things to do right in your backyard between parks, Tier 1 Research Institute, Big Ten sporting events, and so forth, you're right here in the heart of it, the capital. And if you only go 15, 20 minutes, you also get to experience the countryside, cornfields, and rural living, as well as lakes and beautiful nature scenery. So I do believe we have it all.
And this is why Lansing is a great opportunity to show the rest of the country how, by making these connections, how, by understanding this long-term mentality and growth, and continuing to bring the community, the economic opportunities, the natural environment together, creates even a stronger living experience. Because you're right, we have all of those assets right here. We have them within 20 minutes of anywhere in our Tri-County community, which is in the Middle Grand River watershed, which runs right through the middle of everything we're doing. It's the heart of our community. So when we look at this, this is the perfect moment and the perfect opportunity to continue working on this, build these platforms, and show the rest of the country how you bring these assets together and show the next growth models for our country.
And that concludes the second of our three-part series on the CityCraft Foundation, Lansing Growth Fund, and the Southwest Lansing Regenerative Roadmap. Join us next month as we explore further into sustainable redevelopment on Lansing's south side.